My presentation today is mostly on science and engineering labor markets and trends in general, but I've tried to put as much of an IT focus as I could on this. It's also a very data-oriented presentation, so I think it makes a lot of sense for people to jump in with short questions on slides. Long discussions, and we'll never get through it, but jump in on the slides. I'm going to ask your patience to begin with and go through kind of a conceptual view, how to think about science and engineering labor markets, because this is something that affects the data, how to interpret the data that everyone works with and some of the data that I'm going to show you today. And there's really not one way to do it. You could take the 5.4 million that have a science and engineering occupation. You could look at people that have their highest degree in science and engineering and also tell us they're doing work related to their degree. That's about 10 million. And there's about 14 million that tell us that they have a need for at least a bachelor's degree level of knowledge in science and engineering in their field. And you can see in this Venn diagram, this is non-proportional. I'll fix this eventually. Google Chart API has a good proportional one. There's considerable non-overlap between these categories. You have a lot of people with science and engineering degrees, somewhat less so for people in computer science degrees, but still true, who find themselves in a variety of other job titles that do not show up when you look at counts of occupations. At the same time, the occupations may well be filled with people from a variety of majors. Computer jobs is a case which is more so that way, where people are coming from a variety of backgrounds. I haven't actually checked this, but I also would not be surprised if I saw a lot of computer majors working as biologists and other definitions in terms of their formal occupational titles as they get captured in the system. Now, one of the measures that we have is, are you doing a job that's closely related or somewhat related to the field of your highest degree? And one surprise is, in general, across all science and engineering fields, you have not only a high percentage saying they're doing work related to their field, but there's a persistence over time for years since degree. On the right-hand side of the slide, it looks at the same thing for bachelor's degree only and by field, and of course in the computer sciences and engineering, you have the highest percentages of people that through mid-career are saying that they're doing work related to what they learned in their last degree. And sometimes they might tell us it's closely related to their degree and their job title might be salesman. And they also tell us that they're involved in R&D.
But computer science goes down by half. It goes from 60% 1 to 4 years after degree to like 30%. I mean, it's sort of a striking loss in that field. Is that right?
The data is right. In terms of the speculation as to what it means, the big drop is after 25 years since degree. I think the nature of computer science majors 25 years ago might have been quite different, and the rate of movement into things like management for those cohorts could be higher. That's a speculation. Now, in general, and the entire IT field is a good example of it, but not the only example, there's been extremely rapid growth in the United States and abroad in the labor force and employment in science and engineering fields. And we've been growing the jobs, if you will, faster than we've been degree production. This shows a very long view of looking at occupations, science and engineering occupations. I just complained a moment ago that there's a lot of people doing science and engineering outside of science and engineering occupations, but this is what we have measures of to go back longer periods of time. And can look at math and computer science, and you can see that between 1990 and 2000, these are using the decennial census data, most of the growth in numbers in science and engineering occupations were in math computer science occupations. Very rapid growth. In percentage terms, things are there also quite significant growth in physical sciences and life sciences. But in terms of jobs with specific titles, the total numbers in the economy are much smaller. Oh, and some people like the fact that the math computer scientists are edging out the engineers in total number in this, but in some type of one-upsmanship. But and this is just showing that this type of growth is going on through a number of different measures. Researchers in OECD countries has been growing average annual rate of 3.4%. In doctorate holders in the United States in science and engineering growing about 3% a year. Researchers in China growing at about 7% a year. Does anyone know Derek DeSola Price? Yes, he could. He was a historian of science that did a lot of his writing in the 50s and 60s. And if you've ever heard this quote that 80% of the scientists that ever live are alive today, that comes from DeSola Price's very long estimates of the growth rate in the number of scientists and engineers, and simply because the growth rates were high enough and assuming lengths of careers, so long as the growth rate is high, they'll be 80% living and on the right part of the exponential curve. And in 1962, when there were about 1% of scientists and engineers in the workforce, he said, well, the growth has been very fast, but now that it's up to about 1%, we're clearly near satiation. It's now about 5%. I don't know where it stops. I do know, if you want to play the game, that there must be some limit, that under the current trends in 2135, everyone in the United States is a scientist or engineer. I won't make that as a forecast. As I mentioned, growth in science and engineering occupations has grown faster than the growth in degrees, and by a very large portion. In this chart, the very last bar under each of the categories is the growth in employment. The bar right next to it is the growth in any degree attainment. So and you can see that in every field, you've had much faster growth, much faster occupational growth than in degrees issued. In most fields, you have much faster occupational growth than even the PhDs issued. Forgetting my own data. And of course, the biggest discrepancy, if you will, between degree production and employment growth is math computer sciences. This is just some current trends. This is from the Survey of Graduate Students and Postdocs in computer science graduate enrollment in the United States between 1999 and 2006. We actually can go back with a longer time scale. And the top two bars, the solid lines, the red are the foreign students, blue is U.S. citizens and permanent residents. And you had the coincidence of the change in the international situation post-September 11 and the dot-com crash. So you see declines in both the foreign students and the U.S. citizens enrollment. When you break out the U.S. citizens, the dotted lines are racial ethnic categories, but we know them only for U.S. citizens. So you see some decline in white, some decline in Asian Pacific Islander, and some growth in minority, underrepresented minority. Here's the same chart for electrical engineering graduate students. Here, the temporary visa, the foreign students, are a larger proportion of the total. You see somewhat of a similar decline, but more beginning of a recovery on the foreign students, perhaps, at least. And I think, and pretty much the same story for the racial ethnic groups in terms of the enrollment. And here's the actual degree production. The blue is the bachelor's degree, the red is master's, and the PhD I put on a different axis, because otherwise you wouldn't really be able to see the trends. And that's the kind of sickly green color. And you definitely see peaks and recoveries. Now, there has not been good econometric work, good statistical work done modeling choice of major and choice and decisions to go to graduate school in a systematic way. If someone here has done this work, I hope I haven't offended you, but show me if you've got something good. This is a much more spiky pattern, if you will, than you would see in most majors. And what this suggests to me is a greater sensitivity than, say, in the life sciences to labor market conditions. Unproved assertion without a good model. And a very similar picture for degrees in electrical engineering. Now, one thing I noted in both computer science and electrical engineering is there's not really the same type of pattern for the master's degrees. And I need to go back and try to see how many of the people getting master's degrees, particularly in computer science fields, are coming from something totally different, and whether that's an entry into computer occupations for them. One of the questions that we are constantly asked and try not to answer is there a shortage or surplus of a particular type of worker, of a particular skill set? This is harder to answer than you might think, and it might not even be the right question. It's hard to answer precisely because of all the switching that people do between categories. You can't count the number of computer science majors and the number of computer science jobs and think that that's your measure of the supply and demand, because it can be very different. And at the same time, it doesn't necessarily tell us that much. If the market clears, if there's not a lot of job openings, and if there's not a lot of unemployed computer science degree holders, well, that could happen at a very low level of activity or a very high level. So for society, the question might not be the demand, whether there's a shortage or surplus, but is there the number doing the types of things that you want in terms of whatever benefits society gets from there being more people with a particular training doing their work? The science and engineering fields in general have become more linked to the business cycle, because R&D spending has become more linked to the business cycle. And that was particularly true in the dot-com crash. The dark line is the U.S. unemployment rate. The red line is the unemployment rate for people in science and engineering occupations. Much better in general, but you do definitely see in a peak in 2003 that's up to 4%, the highest number that we've seen in the data where we try to do this from 1983 on. The dotted black line is the unemployment rate for people with bachelor's degrees. Used to be that people in science and engineering occupations had much lower unemployment rate than for people with bachelor's and above. Bachelor's unemployment has come down. We do have one computer-related field brought out separately, computer programmers. And as you can see with the dot-com crash and beyond, you did have, briefly, before the recovery, higher unemployment rates for computer programmers than for the general population. Now, one indicator of demand is pay rising. And a number of people have looked at this and come up with different answers. I'm going to tell you why I think my answer is right and theirs is wrong. There have been some reports that have looked at the average wage in an occupation and said, well, wait, the average wage is not going up very much. So it must not be that there's a lot of demand for this. And this was an argument that was being very forcefully made by some people about computer science occupations in 2000 and in 1999, before the crash. The reason they were wrong just to look at the occupational wage, I think, is that when an occupation is growing very fast, guess what happens? The average person in that occupation is less and less experienced because of the rush of new people coming in. And you're also getting people with worse and worse education fits, if you will, a higher proportion of non-computer related majors working in it. This is an attempt to look at pay between 1993 and 2003 for those earning science and engineering degrees in various fields, and how much did it increase for similar people, between similar people 10 years later at the same point in their careers. And as you can see, in math and computer science and engineering, you have above a 20% rate for bachelor's degree holders. This is a real increase in terms of new bachelor's degree recipients in math computer sciences were earning about 23% more in real terms than the same type of people a decade earlier. Over the same decade, the general wages in the U.S. economy were, depending on the index you used, approximately flat. Just another supply and demand indicator, how many people of the new PhDs coming out of U.S. institutions, how many of them 4 to 6 years later are in some type of tenure track appointment? And one thing that shocks many people in academia is in no field do a majority of the graduates end up in tenure track employment. As far as I can find from somewhat inconsistent data, the only time that was true was post-World War II, where there was very rapid growth in faculty. You can very unusual shape, though, here for math and computer science. And for many of the fields, a lower proportion of recent PhDs getting tenure-track employment probably is a sign of some distress. But in the 90s, my interpretation is the sharp decline in the number of new math computer science PhDs entering tenure-track employment was because they had other opportunities. Then came the dot-com crash, and the rate getting tenure-track employment went up again. As actually during this period, there were some increases for most science and engineering fields. This is a very minor point. Until recently, only a very small proportion of U.S. science and engineering labor force were near retirement ages. That was one of the ways we were growing faster than degree production. For your field, this is much less true. As you can see, for percent of science and engineering degree holders older than 50, electrical engineering and computer science are at the bottom of the chart. Postdocs is not a topic that you usually think of very much in computer science and IT. And in all fields, though, there's been a slow increase in the likelihood of a person and having a postdoc experience sometime after their PhD. And while the bottom rows, the math, computer science, the social sciences, and engineering have much lower rates of PhDs entering postdocs, they're increasing to the point that they're not that much different from what the life and physical sciences were several decades ago. In math computer science, about 30% of new PhDs report having some type of postdoc experience after their degree. International topic. I'm going to put some high concept slides on here, I'm afraid. This is something I think everyone knows. In thinking about the international science and engineering labor force and the place of the U.S. science and engineering labor force internationally, you have to think about how science and technology is done and how that has changed. You have much more science and technology types, activity of all types being done across borders, teams and collaborations physically located in multiple countries. And this applies for basic research among university professors. This applies to product development, both high-tech product development and relatively simple design. This is possible in part because of the technologies people in this room have helped to brought apart, but there's another reason to it. It's not just the telephone and the internet. The global capacity for science and technology has been growing very rapidly in most parts of the world. Everyone knows about China and India, and those are certainly great examples. But, you know, if you took China and India out of consideration, I would say exactly the same thing here in this slide. There's been phenomenal growth in college graduates, phenomenal growth in science and engineering degree holders in countries on every continent. And with that increasing capacity, the U.S. is slowly dropping. We're only about a third of the world's R&D now. Now, what that means, I'm going to live really dangerously, and before this group put up a slide that uses the word network, is you've got increased and much more complex flows of students, workers, and finance. More collaboration between Asian countries and European countries, more collaborations within Asian countries, within South American countries, increased regional science and technology collaboration. And there's been a global and regional labor market for a lot of skill sets. Person testified at a public hearing that he was looking for a person with knowledge of this particular regulatory protocol and experience with a particular protein. And there were three people in the world, and one of them happened to be an Irish citizen, so they had to recruit them via the visa process. Anyway, in this, I make the argument that in this, the U.S. is not necessarily the center anymore. We're not the 800-pound gorilla, maybe a 400-pound gorilla, but there are things going on that we are not necessarily the center of. So there's a great deal of increase in the importance of individuals with high degrees of betweenness, people that are connecting the nodes. And a lot of cases, in most cases, that's the foreign scientists and foreign students that are coming to the United States. And having said all that, some people then say, well, if there's all of this going on across borders, why do we care where it's done? And I'll just point out that I think location still matters from national perspective. Most of the flat world metaphor, Thomas Friedman's flat world discussions, I think is true in terms of free flows of people. But those flows are between, if you will, mountaintops, clusters of innovation, and where innovation tends to reinforce itself. And there are reasons that that's very useful to have in your country. In terms of R&D employment, I avoid the word outsourcing because as a purely definitional thing, I don't know what it means. People talk about it as, okay, taking a job from a U.S. worker and sending it abroad. But how do you measure if a company has a research center in two places, has a new research project, and decides to put the research project in Beijing rather than Seattle? Is that outsourcing? How do you measure that? What we do have in terms of data is the R&D employment in the United States and the R&D employment abroad of U.S. multinationals. And what you see is rapid growth of employment in R&D by U.S. multinationals inside the United States. Growth inside the United States in absolute terms faster than the growth in R&D employment at their affiliates abroad, but at the same time, in percentage terms, much more rapid growth abroad, where there's more, as I said, increased capacity. In terms of doctorate awards, international data can be difficult. In this case, I've combined the information on math computer science degrees and all engineering degrees. So to some extent, civil engineering and some other things are in this, but this is necessary because of the number of countries that literally do not report a computer science number because that's within their engineering. And you can see the very rapid growth of China, but a growth also in number of other countries. You get a similar picture looking at first university degrees. Now, for people sometimes ask, the rapid growth in China of first university degrees in math, computer science, and engineering, this does not include the three-year degrees that were sometimes questioned whether they should be included in the counts. But excluding the three-year degrees just puts China back about 2 years in terms of the total numbers. There's a great increase in capacity. I don't know what it means if there's more engineers in China than the United States, because a lot of engineers clearly do things that, if you will, are consumed domestically. There's presumably engineers helping the Beijing Metro to run. But you definitely, as you said, see dramatic increase. In the United States, the foreign-born are an increasing proportion of those in science and engineering occupations, at the doctorate level reaching about 40% in 2005. So this is not degree production. This is of the people with PhDs who are working in a science and engineering occupation in the United States, about 45% are foreign-born. I believe in electrical engineering, it's like 52%, something like that. You can see growth over time. Many people come in under temporary visas. The black section to the right is the essentially computer and programmers and system analysts under the H-1B visa, although there's a variety of others, including this other computer-related occupation. And, of course, some computer science and electrical engineering professors would probably be classified in this under the 8% coming in for college and university education. In the United States, there's a lot of discussion about high-skilled migration and who to let in and what the effect is on natives. But we're really behind a lot of other countries in thinking about it and thinking about its implications. This is just showing that it's not just us, that there's been very rapid increase in skilled migration to a number of countries. Canada brought in about 200,000 college graduates in 2005. There is no U.S. estimate because we don't ask about education. But if you sort of combine incompatible data sources to make a back of an envelope, a good U.S. number might have been about 220,000. Canada, with 11% of the U.S. population, bringing in almost as many college graduates as the U.S. And Japan, which is not a country that lets people become permanent residents very easily, has had very high growth in high-skilled temporary visas. Temporary, but for the most part infinitely renewable. There was a policy change they made in the late 80s to make that possible. China is still sending many more students abroad than it's getting back. They're sending them many places besides the United States. Because I'll just go say quickly, if you look at the blue line, blue bar, that shows the growth in the actual numbers of students returning to China. Most that leave stay away, but they're getting a significant number of returnees doing significant things. And as a national policy, they're really pursuing lots of strategies to bring their diaspora back for a few months, just to make connections, just to try to use it productively, to have a high degree of betweenness, if you will, between China and the global science and technology community. And is there much of a U.S. native diaspora? Well, this may be changing a little bit, but there's actually not that many U.S. natives abroad. I didn't include the slide here where if you look at the number of college-educated citizens abroad, we're number 11th behind a lot of very small countries that have a lot more. There's indications that that's changing, but U.S. students are still not very internationally oriented. I don't know if it makes any difference to us whether our connections with the world are made by our natives going abroad or by the foreign students and foreign scientists coming here, but at the moment it's the foreign students and foreign scientists that are giving us a lot of our connections in the world. And